Okay, is everybody good to carry on? Grand. Oh, I ought to hand out some name placards in case you don't know who everybody is yet. Thank you. So as my name placard states, I'm Tom Cohen. I'm here from the UCL Transport Institute, which you won't all necessarily know. You'll probably know UCL, but the Transport Institute is a relatively new venture. My role as its deputy director is to foster cross-disciplinary work across UCL involving anyone working on transport, and anyone who knows UCL will know that's quite a diverse bunch of people. We're also very interested in policy impact and on interactions with the business community. So we've got 2 hours, and what I hope to cover, as the slide says, I'll do a little bit of scene setting just to, as an aperitif to whet your appetite, if that's appropriate at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. Then we'll hear from Rachel and Ian. I suggest we go in that order. There may be a strong argument for switching, so say if otherwise. They're both going to speak for 10 to 15 minutes on the specific subject of the presentation of cycle safety in the media with respect to London in the case of Rachel and Bristol in the case of Ian. So interesting to see what we hear and the contrast there. We'll have a chance for Q&A after that. It will then be a chance for my colleague here, Roger Geffen from CTC, to talk about the specific case study of the Times and cycling. Most of you, I would have thought, will know something about this. You might all be very familiar with it, but I'm hoping that Roger will give the full story plus his insights. Then I propose to have a brief interview session where I will act as a journalist, if you like, to make this more real and more about the media. I'm going to pretend to be a journalist and interview these three speakers briefly before we have open discussion involving everyone. Does that all sound reasonable? I regret to say that we're not expecting more coffee or tea to arrive before noon, but I'll try to keep us going. Just a thought before we carry on, which is that I'm particularly inspired by what Andrew's been saying. I think, Andrew, you've been rather struck by how there's been a strong narrative that you see as anti-car about this event. And I think one could be forgiven for thinking that that's almost the subtext of the whole event, which I just want to say with regard to this session, whilst cycling is the topic, there is no modal bias in the overall theme of this session, which is about the interaction between media and policy. It just so happens that cycling provides an apt case study to draw upon. I'm modally neutral at work, at home might be different, so I hope that that will come across. Right, so just some scene setting then. This I would present to you as a willfully naive model of the relationship between citizens, the media, and policymakers. Depending on your preferred form of democracy, citizens and policymakers are interacting in some way. Perhaps policymakers are doing exactly what citizens tell them, perhaps not. But the media has this a beautiful impartial role of nothing more than being a conduit of information between the two, telling policymakers what citizens want, telling citizens what policymakers have decided. And of course, because it's naive, it is obviously rubbish, because there's all sorts of other stuff going on. We heard the term framing a lot yesterday. I just cite one writer on the subject. There's a lot of framing happening. In the first place, the media can only cover so much. And by its very selection of material, there is bias entering the fray, possibly quite unintentional. But there's also other stuff going on. The idea of the alarm and patrol models of media, which some of you will know I've taken from Boydston, very much help to explain why it is that we get certain things in the news and don't get other things in the news. And this is also visible in this idea of skew, momentum and explosion, all of which I could try to explain further, but I don't think I need to go into too much detail. There are aspects of the way in which media organisations work that lead them to behave in certain ways and therefore help to determine what we see in the news. All of these mean that the model on the previous slide can't conceivably be accurate. Another thing on framing quickly, which is that actually the previous speaker, Tim, was just talking, sorry, I think it was Steve, was saying it's difficult to change how people think. And in terms of framing, the general assumption is that you can probably change how much people think about something. It's less easy to change what they think about it. But framing is about pressing a subject onto the consumer so that they're forced to reflect upon it more than they otherwise would. Naturally, media organisations have to attract viewers and readers, and they're not going to do that by alienating their readership. So what they say is going to be a reflection of what their readers and viewers want to see. And then this, again, it's taken from Boydston, this concept of the...
Said Boydston too often.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't realise this was just a minute.
Target on fire.
That's how we should be running this session. Yeah. A minute on cycling as represented in the media without repetition. Boydston also talks about media as the fourth branch of government. Well, you can decide how seriously you want to take that as a proposition. But there's no question that the media are part of the establishment. And therefore, they are doing more than simply reporting, again, in this impartial way. They are players in the game. Hence my slightly less naive model of the relationship between media, policy and the citizenry. It's quite obvious to me that the media is a player and therefore is interacting with both other parties. And, I mean, there's nothing remotely revolutionary about this diagram, but it perhaps helps us to think about the things we're trying to understand today. So, in particular, we're not going to spend a great deal of time this morning talking about that relationship, but we're very interested in this one. And maybe we're interested in how citizens might interact with policymakers by way of the media, whether the media does actually provide a conduit in that sense. So I think this is a more intuitive and more accurate picture of how things really happen. And then we get interested in, well, which are the fat arrows and which are the thin arrows? And I suppose more specifically, how do those arrows work? What is the mechanism in which they're operating? So just an example from one study I found, this is from the States, from the 80s, where the fat and thin arrows represent the fact that in the case studied, which was to do with the exposure of fraud in the healthcare sector in the States, the coverage in the media had much more of an impact on citizens than it had on policymakers, which is to say that citizens did two things in response. They both agreed that action was necessary, and they increased the priority of the topic as compared with other things. The policymakers, on the other hand, just agreed that action was necessary, and they didn't respond in terms of changing the priority of the topic. Interesting, I would say. I just throw in for good measure the fact that the stakeholders in this occasion were not affected by media coverage. That stakeholders here, in the article it talks about interest groups, what I suppose we mean are people such as us who know something about the subject and maybe may not therefore be particularly influenced by what we read or see. It's also worth saying that this model is fine, but it's not by any means the whole story. There are examples in the literature of lots and lots of media coverage having no effect whatsoever. One I encountered related to the 2001 general election campaign. Lots of coverage, little public response, little policymaker response. So what's going on here? Well, certain writers say it's definitely not the classical stimulus response model which we tend to see associated with media and publics, where the media says something and the public respond in terms of their attitudes. It's something subtler than that, and I thought it simplest just to express this by putting up a quotation, which I'll just read out. So, more often, news content and journalists play a significant role in setting agendas because politicians use them, which I think is a very interesting verb, in a variety of ways to promote or negotiate agendas and policy options amongst themselves. This is Davis writing about his work interviewing something like 40 MPs in Parliament, so a pretty good sample of the legislature in the UK. Are politicians using journalists? Would journalists like to be described in that way? I don't know. And then this quote from the Cook and All work. Policy change resulted from collaboration between journalists and government staff members. Look, take it either way, what seems to be happening is not the classical model where the media say something and the policymakers respond having read it. And that's clearly going on as well, but it's a much subtler picture. And that's why I think the case studies we're going to talk about this morning are likely to be quite resonant. And this, I think, is my favourite to finish. This is Cook and all saying, "This role, which teams journalist and public official as fact-finder, presenter of reality, and creator of policy result, may be seen by some as inimical to the democratic process." I mean, an overuse of capital letters for sure, but I think an interesting point all the same. There's something slightly disquieting about a situation in which the media is collaborating, colluding with policymakers to create policy. We might be happy if the resultant policy happens to satisfy our personal preferences, but maybe we would like it for the media to have a slightly more impartial role. Anyway, that's enough from me.